This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Eric Dinnerstein, chief scientist at the World Wildlife Fund, where he has spent the past 24 years working to save rare species globally. With World Wildlife Fund, Eric has led many of the organization's most important scientific projects, including the Global 200 Ecoregions, examples of which form the basis of the book Tigerland and Other Unintended Destinations, which won the 2007 American Association for the Advancement of Science Award for science writing. Eric Dinnerstein is here today to tell us about his most recent book, The Kingdom of Rarities, published in 2013. Welcome, Eric.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
It's good to have you. What led you to write your book, The Kingdom of Rarities? What is your goal?
What led me to write this book was, believe it or not, putting my hands through rhinoceros dung. Now, I know that sounds a bit odd. Perhaps some of your listeners are gardeners, since they can relate to that as well, because it's very good fertilizer. But it was a discovery sitting on the back of an elephant one day in Chitwan National Park in Nepal, where I was trying to frame a perfect photograph of a rhinoceros female and her calf in the foreground, and the Himalayas in the background, the 26,000-foot peaks of Dalagiri and Annapurna. It's the only place in the world that you can be sitting on an elephant with a rhinoceros in front of you and such high peaks in the background. And I recognized what spoiled my view was this clump of trees that grew as a woody island in a sea of grass. And I asked my elephant driver, well, why did these trees grow in clumps? And he said, oh, those are old rhinoceros latrines. Rhinoceros, like a lot of other species like antelopes, some carnivores, go back to the same place to defecate. And I started poking around, and I noticed all these seeds in it. And then from these seeds were the species that came from that latrine, a tree called Truia, which we soon named the rhino apple. And I realized from that observation of picking through thousands and thousands of pounds of dung and those seeds that the rhinos, even though they were a rare species, were basically landscape architects, that they could greatly change the way that their own habitat looked. And I began to think, what if we looked at the world from the lens of rarity, from these rare species that have such a tremendous effect on their environments? That's one of the reasons why I wrote the book.
When you say a species is rare, what does that mean? What is the definition?
Well, the classic definition is a species that has a very narrow range, or a species that ranges widely but lives at very low density, or some species can actually have a low range and low density. And, you know, here's the amazing thing, is that something that most people, and even many scientists, don't know, is that rarity is really common. In fact, most species on Earth are rare.
What fraction of species are rare as opposed to common?
Well, think about it this way. The noted ecologist Kevin Gaston from the UK came up with an analysis that for the first time stated that about 95% of all the organisms on Earth are comprised of no more than, say, 25% of all species. But that means, if you turn that around, that as many as 75% of all species are rare. So rarity is, in fact, very common.
Where do the rare species tend to be located geographically?
They're everywhere around us. I mean, here in the Seattle area, there are rare species of plants and animals. Not as many, however, as in the tropics. So if we think about the tropical rainforests, this area of incredibly dense vegetation in the Amazon, in the Congo Basin, in Indonesia, New Guinea, that even though this tropical wet rainforest only comprises about 5% of the vegetation on the land surface of the Earth, more than 50% of species occur there, and most of those are rare. So the rainforests are a hotbed of rarity.
How important are the rare species for the overall functioning of ecosystems? You mentioned the rhino, but say more.
Okay, so let's pick another group that typically occurs at very low densities. And this is one group that most of your listeners will be familiar with. Those are the top predators. So whether they're the tigers on land or the jaguars or the great white sharks, even though they don't occur at very high densities simply because of energetic issues, it takes, for example, a lot of deer to feed a breeding female tiger. In fact, we've calculated it takes about 52 elk-sized deer a year to provide enough energy for a female tiger to breed. Less than that and they won't breed. So you simply can't have a lot of top predators in an area without having a lot of prey, but these top predators will often occur at very low densities because it just takes a lot of food to keep them supported and breeding.
Would you say more about why it is that some plants and animals are rare and others common?
Sure. A lot of it has to do with a very important word, and that word is isolation. So typically, species form, and often because a mountain range emerges or an island drifts off from a mainland or some other physical barrier. So there has to be separation, and often when new species emerge, they're rare. But that separation has to remain for a long period of time. They have to stay isolated so they evolve into being new species. We all learned about that in textbooks from Darwin's visit to the Galapagos. But here's an interesting thing I portray in my book. Imagine for a moment that Charles Darwin and Captain Fitzroy decided to skirt the Galapagos, and instead, when they left from Chile, they landed and they sailed to the Hawaiian Islands. If they had done that, we would be reading not about the Galapagos finches, but about the Hawaiian honeycreepers, a group of birds that showed a much greater radiation of species on the islands of Hawaii than the Galapagos finches on the Galapagos.
How much of a role does human activity have to do with species becoming rare, and to what extent are they just natural?
The reason I start my book on the island of New Guinea was I wanted to select a place where humans had never been. No hunters, no explorers, nobody. Because I wanted to ask the question, even in the absence of humans, is rarity still a common phenomenon? And the truth is, the reality is that it is. In fact, you find the same patterns that you see in the rainforest in New Guinea as you see where no people have ever gone, in this very isolated mountain range, as you do in other parts where people are more common. But there's no question that human activities have driven a lot of rare species even closer to extinction.
What traits do species that have always been rare have in common? Are they different from species that are prevalent?
That's a great question. Typically, they live in habitats that are not widespread. Now, biologists like to talk about species as habitat generalists or habitat specialists. Let me give you an example of a habitat generalist. Human beings, we're almost everywhere. We adapt really well to lots of different environments, from deserts to very cold, very wet, etc. But for a wild species, it really depends on how common their habitat is. So for example, a black-tailed prairie dog, which is very specialized, it only lives in grasslands, but that grassland environment's really, really large, and so there can be lots and lots and lots of prairie dogs. But for a species that likes, say, a particular soil type, a kind of orchid or some kind of plant, that may have a very limited range. And because its habitat is so limited, it too is limited. So species that rely on certain environmental conditions, they can have very narrow ranges. And then, of course, there are species that evolved on islands, and that's the only place they've ever lived, and so they're restricted by their geography.
What is the relation of rare to endangered species? Are rare species automatically on the verge of becoming extinct?
No. There are species, as I said, that have always been rare. So some predators that are not considered endangered, like mountain lions, are becoming increasingly common in the United States and making a real comeback. But mountain lions, like jaguars, like tigers, like snow leopards, they all live at relatively low densities for the reasons I already stated. And there are other species that have always been rare that simply, say, live on mountaintops. They just never dispersed much further than that, and they've been there for eons. But there are species that were once widespread and common and now have become very rare because of human interventions.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Eric Dinnerstein, chief scientist with the World Wildlife Fund and author of the book, The Kingdom of Rarities. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. In your book, you speak about the threat to rare species from converting the rainforest and natural savannas in South America into commodity production for industrialized agriculture. Would you say more?
Sure. And I'll give you an update on a study I'm working on now that has some amazing findings. We know that we live on an increasingly cultivated planet. In fact, 38% of the land area of Earth is now under cultivation. And that percentage is only going to go up as the world population eventually hits 9 billion and hopefully stabilizes at that point. But the challenge for us is, how do we produce the food that we need, the fiber, the other plants that allow us to sustain our lives at the level that we want without cutting down any more rainforest or clearing any more savanna? Now, in the chapter that I wrote about the maned wolf, here's a species that's not really a wolf. It looks more like a red fox on stilts, a beautiful animal. But it is a specialist in the sense that it only lives in grasslands. And it's a species that seems to be able to do okay if the crops that are grown there are soybeans. They can go into the soybean fields and hunt rats. They're big fans of rats. And that's what keeps them going. But other species that live in the savannas of Brazil really can't function very well when it's converted to sugarcane or soy or certainly beef production. But the rainforests are another question, and I'll go on to that in a minute.
Okay. Would you like to say something about the rainforest?
Sure. So remember I said that 50% or more of all species are jammed into 5% of the land area. And if most species on Earth are rare, then by definition, most species in the rainforest are rare. So if we want to save the most number of rarities, we have to figure out how to keep the tropical rainforest standing. One of the analyses that my colleagues at World Wildlife Fund and at the Woods Hole Research Center have just done show that because of the use of rainforest lands, their conversion, and how low in nutrients they are, they often are used for a few years and then they go fallow and they're not productive anymore or not used for crops. But we found that there's an area the size of the country of Colombia, about 1.1 million square kilometers of this fallow land in former rainforest. And we reckon that we can shift all the expansion that's needed for the next 40 to 60 years for pulp and paper, oil palm, rubber, cacao, all the rainforest type crops. We can shift all of that expansion to these degraded lands for the next 40 to 60 years without cutting down any more rainforest.
And how receptive are local governments to this idea?
They're starting to become receptive, but as important, there's groups that are formed around the production of these commodities. So for example, there's what's called a roundtable that addresses oil palm. And some of the biggest manufacturers, the biggest producers of oil palm in the world have agreed to essentially this target, this threshold that we've identified scientifically as below this threshold of the density of the vegetation on it, it's a go zone. And above it, it should be a no-go zone and set aside. You know, for most of my career and for many biologists, our life's work has been dedicated to identifying all the no-go zones of telling developers where you should stay out of. But by using a very simple metric that we developed using a satellite laser scanner to assess the amount of biomass in the rainforest and in degraded lands, we've come up with a threshold that we're below that we can say, this site is not really worth defending, and this could be a potential go zone. And this site over here has much more dense rainforest. Leave it alone.
Earlier, you spoke about habitat specialists, but you also speak about species where there is only one population at a single site. How prevalent are species that exist in this way with only one population at a single site?
About 10 years ago, a number of biologists from all the different conservation organizations got together and formed a group called the Alliance for Zero Extinction. Now, I doubt there's anybody out there. There's such a group called the Alliance for Extinction. Nobody wants to see species go extinct. But the scientific question for us was, what are the next group of species that are like the dodo? And which are the ones that in the next 10 or 20 years, if we don't intervene, are going to disappear? And we decided that that group would be the species that are already evaluated as endangered or critically endangered by the IUCN, the so-called red list of endangered species. And of that subset, which ones only existed at a single site? So plow it, pave it, flood it, burn it, do something else to it, and that species is gone forever. And we did an analysis of all the 28,000 birds, mammals, amphibians, reptiles in the world, and found that there are about 900 species that are found at only 600 sites. So several of these species are found at one site, so that's why we have more species than sites. But if we protected these 600 sites, we would probably be able to head off the first crest of the wave of extinctions that are going to hit in the next 20 to 30 years.
Would you give some examples of the species that are located in these single sites and what type of sites they are?
Some of them have wonderful names, species like the Bloody Bay Poison Frog and the Philippine Gloomy Face Bat. And it's going to be gloomy if we don't protect that site. But the interesting thing is about 350 of these species are amphibians. So I'll give you one example, a place that people wouldn't think about. In the country of Haiti, at the top of the Massif de la Haute are 13 species of frogs that are found nowhere else in the world. Another interesting site is on the island of Cuba called the Zapata Swamp. And that area is like the Cuban's version of the Everglades. And it's the only place in the world to find the Zapata wren and the Zapata rail and the Cuban crocodile and several other species all at that one place. So you save that, and you not only save the rarest of the rare, but many other species whose distributions are quite limited as well.
To what extent might species just not have been found yet?
Certainly, biologists are working hard to identify more and more species. And some people say, you know, we really don't know what to save because all the species haven't been named yet or counted. And my response to that is, more than likely, it's a situation where, if I can put this in some more common terms, the rich get richer in the sense that the places that already have a lot of species that are they're super concentrated, those are likely to produce the species that have even more that we haven't named or identified yet, because they're typically rainforests. For example, there are lots of species of beetles that are limited to the canopy of a few trees in the rainforest. And as we do more surveys from them, we'll probably turn up many more species of invertebrates like beetles that will be named and new to science. But they'll already be in places that we likely have already identified because of some of the other biological wealth that's found there.
Going back just briefly to the habitat specialists, would you give us a sense of what types of animals tend to have habitat specialization?
Certainly, plants and insects tend to be much more special. Well, another way of saying it, though, is really almost all species are habitat specialists. So there are very few generalists. So you can say almost every species is specialized. It's just that if the habitat they're specialized on happens to be really widespread, like tundra or boreal forest, then they're going to be widespread too. But if they live in a very limited range area, like, say, a Mediterranean-type system, like along the coast of California that isn't very large but has this unique climatic environment, then because that space is so limited, the species that live there we can consider often quite specialized in this sort of climate regime of winter rains and hot, dry summers and fire and unusual soil types.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Eric Dinnerstein, chief scientist with the World Wildlife Fund and author of the book, The Kingdom of Rarities. Would you speak now about the use of technology in studying wildlife and how this has helped give insights into the best steps for conservation?
I'd like to say that we are approaching what I would call the NASA moment of wildlife biology. There are so many interesting and exciting new sensors that are out there that we could be using to track rare species and learn more about their behavior. The problem has been that the technologists are not talking enough to the biologists. And then we add a new element in because of some of these rare species that are rare because they're threatened by poachers is the people who are charged with trying to stop the poaching, the people who are interested in intelligence operations. And so one of the projects I've been working on in the last year and will continue to do so in the next few is how you bring these three groups together, the wildlife biologists who study the species, the technologists who come up with these amazing ideas, and then the intelligence experts so that we can intersect all those three circles and find that sweet spot where we can design devices that are cheap, easy to use, and provide really important information on the movements of animals, how many there are, where the poachers are, how to detect them, and how to keep them safe.
What are some examples of where technology has been used to give insightful information?
Some of the most important pieces of information we've had is by using radio tracking, by attaching transmitters to animals and finding out where they move and how big their home range is. For example, when I was studying rhinoceros and tigers in Nepal, we routinely captured those species to be able to understand more about how large their home ranges are, who their neighbors are, who gets to breed, what goes on in their lives. In fact, you can do things like, in the case of rhinos, we would habituate them to our presence on elephant back. And once they got used to us, we could follow our radio-collared rhino along for 24 hours and observe all its behavior, even its mating, even its defecations, which started me going on this, is I can tell your listeners right now, if they're just interested, is that the world's record for a single defecation for a greater one-horned rhinoceros is 54 pounds. I know that because I weighed it. And these are the sort of insights that biologists get, but in a more practical way, as more and more of these high-value populations of species like African elephants and Asian elephants and the five species of rhinos and tigers are under threat by poachers, these tracking devices give us a vital piece of information. They tell us where are the animals that we're trying to save? Where are they at this moment? So we can incorporate that information into our protection patrols.
Which countries are doing the best job in protecting rare wildlife?
If you were to ask me, name the top three countries in the world for conservation, I would say Namibia, Bhutan, and Nepal. Partly because I've worked in those countries and I love visiting them and they're so beautiful and the wildlife is so amazing. But each one has its own interesting story. And very briefly, in Namibia, this was a country that was under apartheid until 1990, but the country wisely gave the ownership of the wildlife to the people. And there you have one of the poorest countries in the world, one of the most backward countries in the world at that time when it achieved independence. And at first, the people were rampant poachers of that wildlife, elephants, rhinos, all sorts of antelope. And then World Wildlife Fund started working there in a project supported wonderfully by our tax dollars, a U.S. aid project that started what was called the Life Project. And that project worked with local communities who had the ownership of the wildlife to use it for their advantage. And now Namibia has one of the most successful ecotourism programs in the world. I describe Western Namibia as the wildlife of East Africa meets the scenery of Southern Utah. It's just a spectacular place to go. And the communities are benefiting so much from the profits of these joint venture operations with hotel operators. And now, in a country the size of California and Oregon and Washington put together, more than 50% of the country will be under some form of conservation. So that's remarkable. And Bhutan and Nepal have other great success stories, too. In Bhutan, 60% of the country has to stay under forest cover. It's written into the constitution, as well as corridors connecting their reserves. So what these three countries point to is that the idea that countries have to become exactly like the United States or Great Britain or Germany and become economic powerhouses before they consider conservation is absolutely false. That even the poorest countries on Earth see the value of saving their wildlife and saving their natural resources and how they can actually use it in a positive way to help build their economies.
Which countries are the most in dire need of better conservation?
I'd like to think our own country. So we had some remarkable achievements. There's one project in our own country I'd like to mention, and actually I wrote about it in my book Tigerland. It's an effort that World Wildlife Fund has started with our colleagues, the American Prairie Reserve, in eastern Montana. And the goal here is to bring back, at least in one place in the lower 48, the wildlife grandeur that Lewis and Clark experienced when they went through the Pacific Northwest. I come at it from an odd way. I'm not an American conservationist, but I've lived overseas long enough for all my life to work there, where I've heard people who know enough about conservation say, you know, you're telling us to save our tigers and our rhinos and our elephants, but what about your North American bison? What happened to them? And it's true, you know, that we almost exterminated a species, but my answer is nothing went extinct from that era, and we can reassemble it, and that's actually what we're trying to do. We're trying to create a new national bison reserve that will be twice the size of Yellowstone, about 5,000 square miles, that will have thousands of bison on it someday, and hopefully as well the top predators that chase them around.
How does an understanding of rare species help lead to insights for conservation overall?
I think that understanding how rare species fit in, because there are so many of them, help us understand, I think, the intricacies of nature. This is not a scientific view, maybe, but it's a personal or spiritual one, that I think that every species is precious, and that the average lifespan of a species in the fossil record is 1 to 2 million years. That's without human beings. These species would live that long and then disappear, replaced by others. But we've been doing an excellent job of hastening that process. So a vast part of my work is to slow it down. Not to slow it down just because it's our moral responsibility, I believe, to do so, but because they're so fascinating. It's so interesting to learn things. I actually believe that there is a part of us genetically that has a great fascination with rarity. That whether, I put on the book, it was because we were trying to expand our monotonous diets, we were looking for new plants, or a better intoxicant, or a better aphrodisiac, or a better healing herb. Our eyes are way back in there. We're trained to notice things that are different, and that manifests it in all sorts of ways. But I believe that it inculcates in us an appreciation for rarity that just maybe isn't tapped in many people, but it's still there.
What do you think are the key leverage points for conservation at this point in time?
I think that most people want to conserve rarities and conserve nature. You know, in all of my travels around the world, I've never heard anybody say once to me, you know, Eric, I'd really like to live next to a degraded environment. You never hear that. Everybody wants to live next to or nearby a clean river and a beautiful area with nice scenery and forests or beaches that are clean. So if that's a given, then how do we create the economic incentives to make that much easier for people to do that? And I think that's really the next frontier for conservation, is to work with new mechanisms, whether it's carbon markets, which will hopefully someday emerge, or a new program that we call the Wildlife Premium Mechanism that, say, for example, returns villagers a higher price for the carbon they might get in involuntary trading schemes, or grazers up in the Himalayas who might get more funds for not grazing their livestock in a national park so that the snow leopards can come back and create an ecotourism industry. If we can figure out these incentives and make them work for local people, it adds a lot of purchase and gives us a chance to get our conservation message across, because it's tied to an economic one and helps lift them out of poverty.
What do you hope your book will accomplish?
I hope that it provides a greater sense, understanding of rarity and the marvelous creatures that we share the planet with. I also hope that the last chapter that's focused on Bhutan talks about how the conservation crisis that we're in is really a spiritual crisis in disguise, that when we can show greater compassion to the species around us, like they do in Bhutan, where I often describe Bhutan's approach to conservation as a mix of the Buddhist Dharma with the latest textbooks in conservation biology, is that I do believe that we're in the early stages of the cultural evolution of our species, and that one marker out there is when we show the same affinity and love for wildlife that we show for our own pets. Now, for example, something that's changed dramatically in the last 10 years is how many people adopt animals from shelters and pounds, whereas 10, 15 years ago, you got your, you know, your purebred something or other. And that change has happened very quickly. And people love their individual pets. Well, I put out there that the next marker in our cultural evolution is when we transfer that love of our individual pet to the love of a species, whether it's the Bloody Bay poison frog or the gloomy Filipino bat or a rhinoceros or a tiger. And many people love tigers. They're the most popular animals on the planet. But how do we make sure that the people who live next to tigers also feel that way? How do we get those economic incentives in place? And that's been my life's work.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I'd say to stay hopeful. I think that we're in this holding action period where we're going through a very difficult time with a lot of poaching of some of these high-value species. But I truly believe that we will rediscover this aspect of ourselves and learn to not only coexist with rarities, but to celebrate them.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you very much.
You were just listening to Eric Dinnerstein, Chief Scientist with the World Wildlife Fund and author of the book, The Kingdom of Rarities, published in 2013 by Island Press. For more information, check on the web at islandpress.org/rarities. Again, that's islandpress.org/RARITIES. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the Streaming Archives section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Demand, and then Podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and kexp.org.